And I'm going to interview Frank Espada, a important person. And Puerto Rican representative. Frank, could you give me some background information, how old were you when you moved to this country?
The first time we came to this country, we came in 1939, and I was 9 years old. And the reason why we came here, ostensibly, was because my sister had a bronchial condition, and that according to the medical knowledge then, required cold weather to cure. I believe as important, probably the real reason, was because my father was not really earning a good living in Puerto Rico. A number of things happened, some of them are very obscure now. He had a number of businesses, and he was at one time a very important person in the Internal Revenue Service there. He was an accountant, or he was an accountant at that time for the government. And a number of things happened. He was also a gambler, and he owned at one point a casino, which was illegal in San Juan, which was raided. He had to sell it. As a matter of fact, I think he sold it just before it was raided to the chief of police, which is a great story. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of things happened around that time to my father, which made things, I think, somewhat untenable for him. There was also a desire on the part of my mother to come to this country. She always dreamt about coming here and so on. I think mm-hmm. she had as much to do with us coming here as anyone else. But as I said, the reason that was given to everyone was that my sister was ill and that we had to come up here to now, that's the first time. The second time was, what happened was that my father...
You mean you came and you went back?
No, let me explain. We were here about 6 months. We first came to live in the west side, 109th Street, with a Dominican family that we helped in Puerto Rico. My father helped quite a bit. They were refugees from Trujillo. They were the Leonor family. And they migrated to the States. Shortly before we did, or I forget exactly when, a year or two before we did, but my father, for a while, supported them, gave them a house to live in. My father owned several homes in the area where we lived, and they lived rent-free. My father even gave him money for food and so on. My father was always a very generous person. So when we came here, we stayed with them for a while, and then we went to live, to live with my aunt. My father stayed for 6 months, couldn't find a job, and came back to Puerto Rico to try to make a living, try to make some money back here. It was 1941 when my grandfather died. My father had come back. My father was already back in Puerto Rico. My grandfather died on my mother's side, and it was just after the war started in 1941, and we took a ship back to called the San Jacinto back to Puerto Rico to visit my grandmother and the family and so on. My grandfather was a very, very loved man, very, very important man in his time in Utuado, where I was born. And the family was very close around him, and it was a very, very dramatic and emotional, traumatic scene when he died. He died young. He died at the age of, I believe, of 56. And his story is worthwhile telling at one point or another. But anyway, we stayed for a while in Puerto Rico, and then we all came back together in 1942. I believe it was 42 when we came back. And again, we took a ship from, and of course it was in the war, during the war, we took a ship to Miami, and then from Miami, we took a train up to New York. That was in 1942, I forget what day it was.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. How did you feel about leaving, and what differences between Puerto Rican culture and American culture did you have to adjust to?
Boy, that's a one big question. Well, it was a very exciting thing for a young boy, 9 at the time. I remember going to San Juan, old San Juan, to be fitted for an overcoat, believe it or not. And an overcoat had to be made up to order because, you know, as you know, they don't have winter clothing there. But it also gave you a notion about the fact that we weren't destitute. My father had money. And we had enough money to pay for everything, pay for the passage and everything. And it was a very exciting kind of time. You know, going to New York was really something then. It wasn't like it was later. It was something that very few people had done up to that time. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at it as a real adventure, mm-hmm. as was my sister, which was, of course, 4 years older, younger than I was. I think she was 5 then. The adjustments I had to make, well, you know, we landed in the winter. It was very cold in the dock, and immediately, and of course, at first the cold weather was a novelty, but the first thing I remember, of course, was the lights in New Jersey going up the river, Hudson River, and how thrilling that was. Not to mention, of course, the fact that I was so glad that we got there because I was sick for 5 days. I believe it took 5 days, the passage. And I was very sick. Mm-hmm. I was seasick. Mm-hmm. But I remember the first impression of the new land, if you will, was the cold weather. And then, of course, we went to live with our friends, the Lenore family. And eventually we wound up in an apartment in Brooklyn. And of course the biggest adjustment I had to make was to the language, because although there was English taught in school in Puerto Rico, I really had to, I don't remember struggling that much with the language, but it was a totally new scene for us. I mean, we lived in a house all my life, and here we are in a small apartment with cold weather, very restricted in movement and so on. My sister and I used to spend our winter evenings with the drawing where you color in the coloring pads or books, mm-hmm. and we used to play a lot of the games, indoor games, of course, you know. And then of course we couldn't have any heat because of our condition, so we had to shut all the heat off. So it was the first winter was a very cold winter for us. All of that. The adjustment in terms of school was very important. In terms of making new friends, that's all very important for a 9-year-old. Mm-hmm. Looking at it now, looking back on it, I think there were very difficult days for me. I survived because I had a good solid family and my mother and so on. But I think that initially the hardest adjustment I had to make was to the language and to school, to try to learn in English, to try to learn English properly, and so on and so forth. So that was my first impressions were all pretty positive. And then of course it was a very difficult period of adjustment, not only to the weather but to the, you know, to the living conditions and to the school and the language and so on.
Okay. Describe how growing up as a minority affected your life.
I think it affected me a great deal. I think everything that has happened in my life was determined in the early days when we lived in an Irish, predominantly Irish neighborhood, and I experienced for the first time a great deal of bigotry and racism and prejudice and so on. I remember very distinctly some incidents that happened to me where I was picked on, or I was beaten, or I was exercised ostracized because of the fact that I was Puerto Rican. I carry that forever with me. I mean, I remember distinctly the names and the faces of the people who showed just a great deal of hatred towards me because of the fact that I was Puerto Rican. I managed to make friends in that area, and as a matter of fact, my best man was probably still one of my best friends, Irish, and there are others that I remember as being good people. But I think that overall, my determination to do something regarding hatred and racism and prejudice and all that had a lot to do with those early years. Mm-hmm. When I first experienced this all these negative feelings and bigotry and so on. That was during my teen years. We lived in West 108th Street at that time, in Manhattan. At that time it was a predominantly Irish, working class Irish neighborhood. That was, we lived there from the time I was about, I think, 12 or so, to the time just before I got married, which was when I was about 20, 19. So it was a very important period of my life, all my teen years. I think, though, I made some determinations regarding where I was, what I was going to do with my life. Perhaps not that early, but later, but I think all those incidents had a lot to do with what eventually I wound up doing. I don't know whether you want any particular incidents or anything like that. I'm not sure you want to get into that.
Is there one incident that is a good example?
Oh, well, there were a number, but there was one incident where there was this one guy named Joe Fleming, who was a pretty big guy. He would go around burning people with cigarettes. He was a sadist. Eventually, believe it or not, this guy wound up in the New York Police Department, which is very interesting. And he was going around burning my friends, and I just wouldn't let him. And I got into a big fight with him. And we had several fights. I had several fights with him, although he was much bigger than I was. But that was one incident. There were a couple of other things that happened, more than a couple, but there were obvious. There were some people in that crowd who really just hated my guts. Felt that I was an intruder and I was a nigger, as I was called often, and so on. But generally speaking, I think that the overall feelings that I had from a number of those people was just one of intense hatred and discrimination. And there were a number of other things that happened. I don't want to go into them. I learned very early about what discrimination and racism and bigotry was about, you know, which is something that I never had anything to do with before. I mean, I was not exposed to any of this. Even the first time I came here, you know, I was very secluded, very protected. But when, especially in the early teen and mid-teen years, which are very important years in a person's life, I was exposed to all of this sickness. And there were a number of things that happened to me afterwards, after I grew up. But I think those early years were most formative in terms of making determinations regarding where I was going to do. My feelings have always been very strong about justice and human rights, and there's nothing that would get me more riled up than injustice, to see an injustice done to a human being, or a human being to be violated in any way. I think that had to do with my upbringing, my mother particularly, who believed very strongly in that. Plus the what I just finished telling you, all the things that happened to me behind all that. That's not saying that I didn't have some good friends and I had some nice memories about those years also, because I was very active in sports and I was a pretty good baseball player. And as a matter of fact, I wound up being the captain of that team. Something called the Crusaders, and played a lot of basketball and so on. But it was tacit acceptance on the part of many of them. I was a reality, I was there, you know, and as a matter of fact, I remember adjusting all kinds of things or trying to be more and more like them. And I didn't have all that many Puerto Rican friends in those days for the most part. I had some, but not that many. I used to hang out with this. Well, that's where I was, that's what I lived. Mm-hmm. Anyway, next question.
How did you get involved in civil rights?
Well, it was during the, I think it was in 1963, 61, 62, around there, 60. Well, it's early 60s. I had not been involved to that point, since I like to play baseball and softball, it was a softball league in Brooklyn where we lived, and you were all, at that time, you were just born and the kids were young. And I joined the softball league, and the softball league was sponsored by something called United Community Centers out there in East New York. That's how initially I got involved in any kind of organized activities, and then after that we were in several demonstrations that were organized by the, perhaps if not organized, that the community center participated in. And from there we started something called Human Rights Council. That was about 64 or so. In 65, the Human Rights Council received, or rather the United Community Centers received some poverty agency money. That in those days, the anti-poverty program just come in, 1965, and we opened a storefront in one of the worst areas in East New York, Sutter Avenue. That was the year, 65, where we had the serious riot in East New York, and I was involved in that to a great extent.
How?
Well, because of the fact that we had the office right there, and I had some people working for me.
Well, I'm not really familiar with that riot. Could you tell us?
Well, the riot had to do, of course, there had been some riots around the country before, prior to this, and there was a riot in Bedford-Stuyvesant in 1964. And the conditions were very tight throughout, and the riot in East New York started an incident between the blacks and Puerto Ricans, and it lasted 10 days. But it really started, not, I take that back, it didn't start as, it ended up as being that, but it started as an incident that happened out in the eastern end of the community between the young Italian youth and the blacks out there, because the eastern end was where the Italians were, Nulats, the remnants of the old Italian families. And that's where the blacks were, also many blacks. I moved into the area that was an old Jewish working class community for many, many years prior to that, East New York was. So it started there, it grew into a serious riot. There was a young boy that was shot and killed. And then through the tension mounted, and there was an incident between a black and a Puerto Rican family, and that started another section of the riot over in West End between blacks and Puerto Ricans. That lasted 10 days. I was involved in it, trying to identify the leadership, and eventually we brought the thing to a halt. I remember going with police inspector, black police inspector named John Lloyd Seeley, who was a very, very fine man, to a meeting in a glass-littered playground between five blacks and five Puerto Ricans. And that led to another meeting that evening in which the leadership met in a small food hall. And there were groups of people outside waiting for the result, waiting for the results of this meeting, very tense and very dramatic. And finally, they, in the midst of all this, this couple of young black kids come running in and saying, screaming that some Puerto Ricans had thrown a firebomb into this black house. And the thing was about to break again, and finally the black leader, black individual, Bill Wright, rose to the occasion and really imposed his will on the entire group, urging them to cool it. And one of the most dramatic moments of my life. The thing was pulled out of the fire at that point. Then they came out, they went out, and they spoke to the crowd, and that settled it. And the next day, we had a meeting in the storefront, at the United Community Center storefront, Sutter Avenue. And I had, at that point, been in touch with the mayor and all the mayors and Lindsay's people and so on. And we then asked for a meeting with all of the commissioners, the city commissioners, and every one of them showed up except, of course, the police commissioner. That was kind of dramatic, and we had this meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the day after the riots subsided. And we asked for...
How did you get them to stop fighting?
By bringing the leadership together. You bring the leadership together and you sit them down and you negotiate certain things out. And, you know, people don't really want this kind of thing. A lot of people were hurt, and our storefront became kind of a field hospital. People working in there and they were busted up. And it was very, very, very shaky, very hairy, and very scary. It was, you could read a newspaper at night from all the fires that were going on. A lot of buildings were set on fire, especially the abandoned ones. And of course, the fire department at one point stopped coming in because they were afraid the snipers were up on the roof and all that. So it was very, very, very scary, very, very brutal kind of thing. Nobody really wants that. Nobody gets hurt but the people in the ghetto. At one point, there were something like 1,500 police in that area. They just flooded the area with cops. And of course, then Lindsay took credit for ending it, for stopping the whole thing, which was very, really, really funny. He had a meeting in the blue room in the city hall, and he called all of everyone in. And as a matter of fact, he gave credit to someone, a black guy, who had very little to do with stopping it. Okay, I'll never forget that. And publicly, he gave credit to this guy, and everyone knew that this guy had nothing to do with stopping. But anyway, that's besides the point. It was just the opportunistic politician taking advantage of the situation. He had cooled the situation. Lindsay, at that time, really, really controlled the media. The media really played up to whatever he wanted in terms of de-emphasizing what was going on, in these communities. And there were many riots that were not even reported or that were played down as just minor disturbances during the first Lindsay year, which was 65, and later on, of course, 60, 66, 67, 68. And he took to walking the streets when things were pretty safe, but never when things were really tight out there. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's essentially the story of that riot. The conditions out there in that community were extremely poor. They still are. We did get some concessions that were ignored after a little while, and we went and we picketed again. We did a number of other things. But overall, that's the story of that riot. And that's when I really became fully involved in this whole business. Shortly after that, we broke from the community center and we started something called the Human Rights Council, a small group of people. And it was at that time, the Human Rights Council, or rather the East New York Action, it was called. We were over on Blake Avenue, and it was a small group of volunteers, all middle-class people.
Were you employed by them?
No.
You were just doing this as a volunteer?
This was volunteer group, yeah. And the most significant thing that came out of that, we tried a number of things, but we really weren't all that expert. Most of us weren't. I spent a lot of time there organizing some rent strikes and organizing some other things. But for the most part, it was just a well-meaning attempt on the part of a bunch of middle-class people to do some things. And after a while, some people lost interest, and there was no money to maintain the thing. They had to pay rent and so on. And we threw two or three fundraisers to try to keep the place going. But the most important thing that came out of that was my involvement in the welfare rights movement. At that time, I had been hearing about some efforts at organizing welfare clients from the Lower East Side, and I went to a series of lectures by a guy named Dick Cloward from Columbia University, who effectively was the theoretical father of the civil rights movement, of the welfare rights movement. So what happened thereafter was that I went out and I organized something which I call the Welfare Recipients League, different chapters, and then we had, and it caught on very, very quickly. That's the whole story of the welfare rights movement. It was really one of the few.
What did you say you had? You started a Welfare Recipients League?
Yeah.
What's that?
Welfare recipient. You know what a welfare recipient is?
Well,
it was a league, of chapters, a league of little groups. So we had an alliance of these groups. And I went around organizing these groups throughout to demand rights, to demand primarily minimum standard benefits, and to demand certain other things, to demand the cessation of violation of personal liberties. Okay, so there were a number of things that we tried to stop. For example, it used to be that a welfare investigator, as they were called, could come into the house any time at all, just to check up to see what was going on, without announcing. And they would always be looking for what they call the man in the house business. And looking under the bed, looking in the closets to make sure to see the men's shoes there, or whatever. And of course, the welfare clients weren't allowed to have. If a woman was living alone with several children, she would claim welfare because she didn't have a means of support. Sometimes there was a man around, sometimes there wasn't. Sometimes a man would split on purpose so that the woman could get on welfare. So we put a stop to that. We put a stop to the breaking and entering type thing that we call it. As a matter of fact, the welfare clients couldn't even have a telephone. And there was many, in a number of cases, where a telephone was essential. There are a number of long list of things that we got. We took the entire welfare structure in New York City. We shook it up. We really did. We came up with something called minimum standards form, where by law, by regulation, a family of four, for example, was supposed to have four chairs, supposed to have each a dish, basic things. Mm-hmm. And in many instances, that was all ignored. They're supposed to have a place to sleep, and not sleep on the floor, beds for X number of people, and so on. And we used to go down a list. We had made a list of items, minimum standard form. And the welfare client would check it off and sign it and give it to the chapter chairman. And then that would be handed over to the welfare office. And they would meet every week and discuss what took place and so on. The welfare rights movement grew so quickly that by this summer, in less than 6 months, it was already a major national movement, and we went to Chicago to organize the National Welfare Rights Organization. We drove to Chicago to organize that. That was in 1966. And we had a national demonstration. I think, believe it was 32 cities all on the same day to show our strength and so on. I was the first chairman of the citywide coordinating committee on welfare for welfare groups. I was the first chairman, although I wasn't on welfare or anything, but I was recognized as an organizer. And at that time, that's mostly what was needed, was an organizer type. And we organized this. A lot of groups, I forget how many groups there were altogether, more than 30 or 40 groups in New York City alone. And then we went to, just before we went to Chicago, I forced the issue about me being chairman. I didn't want to be chairman. And that's when Beulah Sanders became chairman, and she remained chairman of the Welfare Rights. She became chairman of the Welfare Rights Organization, and She went all over the world and everything. She was a welfare client. And she went all over the world. I mean, she went to Hanoi, she went to mm-hmm. Paris. And she got involved in left mm-hmm. politics and mm-hmm. so on. George Wiley, who is now dead, died in an accident, was a PhD in chemistry. He was had something called Poverty Rights Action Center here in Washington. And he eventually became more or less the director. And his mentor, of course, was Dick Cloward and Fran Piven. So that was kind of an important offshoot, as far as I'm concerned, of that civil rights and human rights and organizational phase of mm-hmm. Coalition New York Action.
So all this time when you were doing this, you were doing something else?
I was working as an estimator in an electrical construction firm. I worked there for 10 years, and I was working all this time.
What's that?
What?
An estimator.
Well, you estimate the cost of electrical construction jobs.
How did you get the time to do all this stuff?
I did it at night, on the weekends. I was devoting more and more time to it, and then when was the World's Fair? 1967, right? 67? That was the World's Fair, right?
Oh, the World's Fair?
That's when... The World's Fair was 1967, and at that time, we were connected with the core organization, the Congress of Racial Equality, you know, East New York Action. So we participated in a demonstration when the World's Fair opened, or over 800 people arrested at that demonstration. Because we were protesting all this money being spent on this fair when all this misery was going on. And that was the first time I was ever arrested. We were taken to Hart's Island, which is an island in the East River. And we were kept there, I think it was 3 days, right? We were being processed. And I was supposed to be out there in the World's Fair monitoring the Spanish Pavilion electrical work that we had done, that my company had done.
What?
My company had installed the electrical system for the Spanish Pavilion at the World's Fair. And I was supposed to be out there helping monitor that. Instead, I was in this demonstration, and I was arrested. And, it was shortly after that that I was offered a job working in a Puerto Rican anti-poverty program that had just been created. And then I went ahead and I left the electrical construction.
You left it, or you were fired?
No, I left. I wasn't fired. They never learned about that.
Oh, okay.
But what was really interesting was around that time also I had several press conferences regarding the welfare rights thing, and they couldn't get over it. They were in a state of shock in at work, because they were really very conservative group of people. And here I was, my paper, my picture over the paper, talking about welfare rights and organizing a welfare client union, and they couldn't get over it. And I was the object of a New York Daily News editorial entitled "Now We've Heard It All." You know, the Daily News is very conservative, so they were very shocked about all my activity. They never imagined I was involved in anything like that. That was about the time when I gave them notice. I had already gotten the offer to go to work for Puerto Rican Community Development Project, and I went to work for them. And I wasn't there more than about 6 months, and I was offered this job as with the Community Development Agency, which had just been created in New York City, the Poverty Agency, the Anti-Poverty Agency.
Wait a minute, it was called the Anti-Poverty Agency?
No, it was called the Community Development Agency, but it was the local CAP agency, Community Action Program Agency. It managed all the funds for the anti-poverty program in the city of New York. And that led to a tremendous amount of organizing at the local levels, organizing community corporations. I was there, I think, about 2 years. And then from there, I went on to become the executive vice president of something called the New York Urban Coalition. That was in 1968. I believe it was in the spring of 1968. The Urban Coalition was organized primarily by high-powered business types, and it was an attempt to coalesce the labor and minorities and business to deal with the problems of the inner cities. They were really afraid of the riots, that's why the reason they organized it. So I was with them for about a year and a half, I think it was. Did a number of interesting things while I was there, and also was very aggravated about a number of other things, about the inability to get some things done.
What did you do? What do you mean by interesting things?
Well, I was responsible for the economic development and the housing side of the issues. And we created something called Coalition Development Corporation to lend money to minorities, business people, and so on. That was interesting. And then we did some things in the housing field also that were kind of interesting. But beyond all that, I was very much involved in the very high levels of government at that time. I was fairly close to the Lindsay administration, and I was also involved in some more of a riot duty in the summer of 68, 67 and 68. By that I mean that I was involved in trying to quell riots and identify leadership and so on. And that lasted until the end of 68. The end of 69, I resigned from the coalition. I believe it was the first part of 70. And that was the last direct involvement I had with all that stuff. I was involved in a number of other things nationally, organizing coalition between Puerto Ricans and the Chicanos. And as a result of one of my activities, I was involved in this conference that took place in 1971 called the Unidos Conference here in Washington. I brought together over 2,000 people, Chicanos and Puerto Ricans and some Cubans. And that led to other kinds of involvement in the Chicano community. So I did any number of things throughout the country with the organizing coalitions of various kinds. The National Latino Media Coalition was one of those efforts. There was a manpower organization that I belonged to that I was vice chairman of. That happened in 73. Several other activities that took place thereafter related to the Chicano Puerto Rican Coalition. Eventually I became the National Field Services Director for something called Bilingual Children's Television. That was a very unhappy experience for me, because the director of that, it became eventually a children's bilingual television program called Villa Alegre, but the director was a ripoff artist, and I went to war against him, and it was a very difficult thing that I had to do, but we stopped the funds. And around that time, I came down here in 1973, and on a fellowship to the Drug Abuse Council to do some research in the area of Puerto Rican drug addiction. As a result of that experience, I organized something called the National Association of Puerto Rican Drug Abuse Program.
Whoa, you're going too fast.
In 70...
How did you get into the drug abuse field?
Well, I was offered a fellowship, a one-year fellowship to study, do the whole number in terms of studying. This is a think tank, the Drug Abuse Council was no longer in existence. And I was offered a position as a fellow for 1 year to look at the whole issue of addiction and treatment and so on in the Puerto Rican community. As a result of that, I called a meeting of Puerto Rican directors of Puerto Rican, from predominantly Puerto Rican agencies, drug treatment agencies. And as a result of that was in the summer of 74. As a result of that meeting, we came out with something called the National Association of Puerto Rican Drug Abuse Programs. I was connected with that organization as the national coordinator, unpaid, for about 5 years, 6 years. well, 74 to 79, so it was close to 5 years. We had several exciting things that took place during that phase. We organized, as a result of a speech I made in San Francisco in 1974, was it 75? As a result of the speech I made there in San Francisco in 75, we shook the tree because of the fact that the entire field was controlled by white males. And we started, as a result of that speech, we started something called a National Coalition Ethnic Drug Abuse Association, which was in effect a coalition of all the minority groups. We did a number of things with that coalition, not nearly enough, because there was a lot of self-interest involved in it, as far as other people were concerned that were involved in that. But we did make an impression for a while upon the entire field. The association put on two or three very important conferences in Puerto Rico. They put on two in Puerto Rico, and they were very much a part of the developing awareness of the need to involve minorities in the policy and personnel. I left the association last November, a year ago today, and it hasn't really done too much. Not because I left it. I think it was at that time it was already interest had lagged or flagged that in terms of the association. In any case, that covers maybe one tenth of some of the things I've done. I left that a lot, but right now, as you know, I'm involved in in this.
I'll get to that later.
Okay. Well, significant gains. Well, I think that there's been gains in the area of employment. I think there's been gains in the area of education, and that is in the sense that many more people have gone on to higher education, and particularly in the field of law and business. Talking now strictly from the Hispanic or Puerto Rican viewpoint, I think overall affirmative action has had some impact across the country. I think that there is more of an awareness of minorities now, or perhaps less of an awareness, which is good. I mean, I think that minorities are accepted for the most part in certain conditions, under certain conditions, blacks and Hispanics, in the workplace, in the universities, colleges, institutions of higher learning, have been more open. There was a period where they made some fairly impressive efforts to recruit minorities. Other gains, I think overall, if you look at the statistics, I think that the generally poor people, which are mostly the minority folk here, are worse off probably now than they were 10 years ago in terms of it has had to do a lot with the inflation. But I think that the buying power of poorer people is, according to the figures I saw or heard about, is that they're not now no better off, at least at best no better off now than they were 10 or 15 years ago when all this business started. But there have been some improvements, the ones I mentioned before. Of course, with the recession and the depression now, the minority communities are feeling it a great deal more than anyone else. They always do. The food stamp program happens to be probably one of the few things that is really keeping the lid on in terms of these communities. Because if it wasn't for that, we would have some serious problems at the local level in those communities. What other gains do I see? I think that the young people have taken a lot for granted. I don't know whether that's a gain or not, but if you look at it from the point of view of almost an elder, I could say that a lot of young people have taken for granted everything that was done in those days. perhaps that's good. I don't know. Maybe, but I say, you know, they're making the same mistakes, and they're doing the stupid things that some of the stupid things that we did. And there's no real sense of history in the newer generation. I think that's probably negative. But if looking at it from the other perspective, you say, okay, maybe well, that's good, because people are saying, well, you know, things are better, have to be better now, because they're not faced with the same conditions that we were faced with, dealing with.
That's what I was going to say. How do you expect someone who's a different generation and has born in this country to not make the same mistakes. I mean, a new generation is going to do things their way, and they're not gonna see it the same way. I mean, that's the way it always is. Right?
I understand that. I think that this culture does not appreciate older people. I think that the young people in this country have no sense of history for that reason. It's not like most other countries where the young people look to the elders in terms of experience, you know, and they look upon the elders as a very important resource. I think that the attitude in this country towards older people is very defeating in that sense. Mm-hmm. I also think that we did not do a very good job of chronicling what we did. Okay. That's an important point. That all of the stuff that I'm telling you about easily could be a couple of books. I mean, because there were a number of other people who were involved who had other things to say. We didn't even go on the lecture circuit or anything like that. Although I was asked to speak in various places throughout this whole period, but it was more like, you know, I was the current spokesman, and this was the hot issues of the day, and therefore, you know, I remember talking at the New York Ethical Society. I remember another speaking engagement at the Young Presidents League, all the presidents of corporations under 40. I remember several engagements, speaking engagements of that sort. In those days, in 66, 67, 68. But we never really made a serious attempt. Oh, of course, I was on television several times, and I remember giving an interview of this type at WBAI, which is the public station Pacifica Radio in New York, before I got into CDA and all that, when I was chairman of 42 different organizations. And that interview went for over an hour and a half or something like that. It was kind of a very temporal thing. See, it happened, or I would be interviewed for an article in the paper, or something would be written about what I was doing, what we were doing, and then it would pass, and no one really nailed it down and organized it in terms of a history, because it was a history. It was very important. Part of what happened in this country in the 60s, what we were involved with, was a very important part of it. But anyway, the answer to the question, there is an answer, is that there are many factors why that contribute towards the whole issue of reinventing the wheel and ignoring what's past. I think that the prime factor is the fact that, as I said before, that older people are not looked upon very kindly in this country. And they're just something to be pushed aside. And this is a very youth-oriented culture, which is too bad.
So that is what limits the gains, do you think?
To some extent, yes. I think so. I mean, it seems logical to say, you know, you build upon what other people before you have done. I mean, that would be the most logical thing to do. I'm not sure that's what happened. I think that the pressure was put on, several laws were passed, several procedures and regulations were changed, several institutional attitudes were moved one way or the other to open some doors and to begin to redress the grievances. But I don't think anything really was done in a very organized way. I don't think that there was any real continuum of the effort, which is one of the reasons I think why the civil rights movement and the human rights movement in general kind of just dropped dead, because there was no real follow-up. There was no consistency in the movement. And I'm sure all this has been analyzed and so on. A lot has been written, mostly by people who were not involved. I read a couple of histories of the welfare rights movement where it's just absolutely off the wall. No one really has done it properly, the way that we saw it, from our viewpoint. No one really came forth with a strong defense of the anti-poverty movement, which it was a movement. It was looked upon by all the detractors of the program as a boondoggle and wasted money and all that, but a lot of good things happened out of the anti-poverty program. A lot of organization took place that has come to the fore in terms of political organization, which is what we were after. And there have been a number of people that were elected that came out of that, in New York City, that came out of that movement. It was an anti-poverty movement. This is what we called it. Local level politicians, city councilmen, etc., and state representatives that were involved in those days and who learned to organize politically as a result of their involvement in this program. What else?
That's pretty good. Okay. Describe the project you're currently involved in and tell me what your ultimate goals are and what the significance would be if they were achieved.
The project that I am now directing called the Puerto Rican Diaspora Documentary Project, it's an attempt to chronicle the migration experience, the Puerto Rican migration to this country, as well as to document the present conditions of the community today. It is being funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, and is being done under the aegis of Boricua College, which is the only four-year bilingual, bicultural institution, educational institution in the country. The objectives, as I mentioned before, are to, for the first time, to try to bring about some understanding about what's happened and what's going on in these communities. We now have over 2 million Puerto Ricans in this country, and it happens to be probably the most massive migration of people from a different cultural and linguistic background in the Western world, certainly as far as this country is concerned. The underlying objective, of course, is the preservation of the culture, Puerto Rican culture. There's an organizational element in this project that will hopefully bring about a number of communities throughout the country, and we'll be using primarily the issue of culture to do this. The photographic essays will document 13 different phases of Puerto Rican life in this country, which will result in a traveling exhibit. And at the same time, we will be organizing a collection of Puerto Rican memorabilia and documents and all newspapers and newspaper articles and whatever describes the migration experience. That will all be housed in two places, one the Boricua College and the other one the Museo del Barrio, the Puerto Rican Museum in New York City. In addition to all that, there are going to be a number of activities at the local level revolving around the project. And the activities will be primarily of cultural nature. Some of them will be one-time, others will be recurring activities. There will be other activities also related to more permanent kinds of activities, such as the organization of Puerto Rican cultural centers, etc., throughout the country. Eventually, that whole business is going to be brought under one umbrella called the National Puerto Rican Cultural Alliance. The collection will continue ad infinitum. It will become the repository of our experience, information related to our experience in this country. And the exhibit will result in a book that will be published hardcover probably in the spring of 1982. Plus, in addition to all of that, there will be television programs and radio programs and so on that will come out of it, out of this whole experience. I'm doing the majority of the photography. I have over 50 people throughout the country that are advising me on a national advisory board. And I have some of the top people in New York City involved in the whole technical and artistic end of it.
Is that it?
Anything else you want to
know? Well, you mentioned to me that it would be a very significant achievement if, well, you know, all this. How do you think it would change anything or affect? What would its significance be?
Well, initially, I thought of this project as having some beneficial, positive effects on the non-Puerto Rican or dominant culture, the Anglo people here, the Anglo society. And eventually, I came to the conclusion that really wasn't the important thing. I think that the most important thing that we can do here is to reinforce the cultural identity of our people out there. I think that's most important. I think that there's a recognition that our culture has been Americanized over the years, through the years, you know, 82 years now of American dominance in Puerto Rico. And so we feel that, particularly in this country, that we're losing our culture. We're losing some of the more beautiful aspects of the culture, and that's what I think now at this point is most important. I think whatever comes out of it, as far as more positive way of looking at the Puerto Ricans in this country, we're all fine and dandy. But I think that, as I said, I think that in my mind right now, the most important thing is to reinforce our own identity, a cultural identity here. Also, it will bring together a number of communities around the country that feel isolated. We have probably more than 50, 60 communities out there with more than 10,000 people throughout this country. And many of them feel very isolated, like people in Vineland, New Jersey, and then people in Lorain, Ohio, and people in Lansing, Michigan, and San Jose, California, and on and on and on. All these people, many of them, expressed to me the necessity to organize culturally, and, you know, to try to organize something on a national level. And that's what's going to happen. As a result of this also, we hope to institute some annual events that can be called annual events that all happen the same day. Huh? Mm-hmm. For example, there's the San Juan Festival that happens in several places throughout the country, but they happen at different times. It would be, some people feel that it would be a beautiful thing if we could say June 12th, say, is San Juan, Feast of San Juan, St. John, San Juan. And so that there will be an attempt to do that. There will be an attempt also to establish Puerto Rican cultural centers in several places. And of course, in unity there is strength, so that we'd be able, hopefully, to attract some funds as a national cultural alliance organization instead of just the local groups here and there.
Okay.
Anything else you want to know about that project?
Is that all you want to say about it?
At this point, yeah. You know, it's a big job. I'm starting in New York City and then moving on to Puerto Rico as soon as it gets a little colder.
Can I come?
And then from there I'll go to go out west and come back, work my way back. I'll go out to Hawaii and work my way through back.
Can I come? Please.
Let's keep this on a very professional level. What else do you want to know?
I want to know, what do you predict for the future of Puerto Rico and the Puerto Rican people in the United States?
They're two different things, although they're intertwined. The future of Puerto Rico is, future of Puerto Rico is, I'm sorry to say, I don't think I'm going to see what I like to see in my lifetime, which is independence. I think that a tremendous amount of dependence has been built up through the years. We're somewhere around 60-65% of the people in Puerto Rico are now on food stamps, and there's somewhere between 35-45% unemployed. The economy is in shambles, there's rampant unemployment. there's been more and more of a move towards statehood. Of course, I don't believe that there's going to be statehood for that country. I think that there's too much racism here. I think that statehood would mean two Puerto Rican senators and probably five congressmen.
So you're against all that?
Huh? I'm against all that, but I don't think it would happen anyway. I think that that would have to pass both houses of Congress. I don't think that stands a chance. So I see a continuing dependent relationship under the Commonwealth status. I see the country more and more dependent. We're now somewhere around 90% of the food that's consumed has to be imported. So it's a very bad, very sad situation there. The cultural aspects of that community down there are not anywhere near what it used to be. That is that, of course, there have been many attempts to infuse life into the heritage and the culture and so on. The community here in this country has a long way to go. This is a very poor community, it's undereducated, it's very young, it's a very young community. It also has probably the highest dropout rate from high school of any. It is not a stable community in the sense that people keep moving around within the states and also back and forth to the state, to Puerto Rico. So that you can't really pin it down in terms of a community that's stable, that stays in one place. It's a very mobile community. There's still all the problems of racism and bigotry and prejudice and police violence and poor education and lousy housing and the workforce is the lowest in the socioeconomic scale. Therefore, they wind up doing all the dirty work. But as I said, they're a very young community, which is one of the better points, positive things. There are more and more Puerto Ricans that are being educated, that are going to college and becoming lawyers, becoming accountants and teachers and so on. And there are some political gains that have been made here and there. We're still very, very underrepresented and politically powerless, for the most part, throughout. So we have a long way to go. There's a lot of community development type things that have to happen. There's a lot of political organization that has to take place. And there's a lot of work to be done in the educational area. So those are the three main things that I see as the next decade, this 80s decade, for the community to concentrate on. Hopefully, we will support a lot of that stuff through the awareness and the culture and heritage and so on, which is one of the reasons why we're doing this other project. The gains are small. They come in very small doses. They're minimal in many instances, and in some instances there's some retrogression. But for the most part, we have second and third generation folk now here, which is a hardy and very, very tough strain of people, brought up in the ghetto and very resourceful and very aggressive. So we have that to counter all the other negative things. And we still have our ties to the island. In many instances, the ties are strong to particular hometowns from one location or another. In Hartford, there's a connection, very strong connections to one town called Aguadilla in Puerto Rico, and from Lorraine. There's some strong ties to my hometown, to Ado, and so on. So there people work here and they send money home. You know. So there's still strong ties back there. So that's kind of important. You know. How this country sees Puerto Ricans, I think for the most part we're still seen in a very, very poor light. I think we're people on welfare and people who are always in the news behind some violence or something negative, which is another goal of this project I mentioned before, is to bring out some more positive things in terms of this community. There are a lot of good things that are going on, and very good people doing some good things, and people who have excelled in their fields and who should be highlighted, who should be brought forth, who should be spotlighted. So.